Right. Well, I've been interested in the classical spinning particle problem in a gravitational field. Problems: if you drop a spinning ball on a non-spinning ball, they don't follow the same path. It's a violation of the equivalence principle. That's kind of frustrating. I've come up with a new action principle which can sort of recover the motion of a spinning particle as sort of a geodesic. One of the issues that you have to deal with is the variation of velocity is no longer the velocity of the variation. It's anholonomic. And I've been able to write down a Lagrangian for a classical spinning particle. And then having done that, it's kind of interesting to think about how that might be a source of gravity, spin contributions. So let me do some hand waving for a little bit, just to give you kind of an idea of how I've approached the problem, and I'll kind of back it up with something much more solid about halfway through the talk, hopefully. Let's just look at kind of three-dimensional relativity, how we do it. We would consider that we have an invariant, which is sort of, we take a scalar quantity, the energy, and subtract from that a vector quantity, the momentum. We may view this as the momentum motion increases the mass somewhat, and that's what we call just the kinetic energy. It's more convenient to write that in than a four-vector notation. Then this invariant mass is simply the length of the four-vector. Now let's take a little bit of kind of a jump in dimensional concept. There is another invariant that people write down, although it's not, doesn't appear widely. It's hard to find this in books. But when you have a classical spinning particle, the mass is not an invariant. You must take the mechanical mass and subtract from that the component due to the spin. Now, if that looks a little strange to you, just sort of work it back around, and what you get is that the inertial mass of the object has been increased somewhat by the spin motion. Or if you like, there's been rotational kinetic energy. If you rotate something faster, it has a little bit more energy. Of course, that kind of behaves like it has more mass. Now, if this is a quadratic form, a length, then I might consider writing down an object which is part vector and part bivector, and that this invariant would be the length of that object. That's kind of what I've used as a source of my object to extremize my Lagrangian. I'm just completely off to the side, but to kind of give a flavor for why you would consider doing mechanics this way and adding a vector to a plane. In electrodynamics, of course, so in 3 plus 1 view, we have a scalar equation, a vector equation, and we unify it together into one equation using 4 vectors. If you use a Clifford algebra, don't really have to go there today, but that's kind of where the motivation factor was for me. You may write this in a very nice form, which is more easily integrated. We can then also do something very parallel. If I adopt that type of form I was talking about, where I, off the bottom, have a polyvector, which is part vector and part plane, which has both the linear momentum and spin momentum in it, then I can write the equation of motion for the linear part and for the spin part in one single form, which is means you could solve for both motions simultaneously. This type of approach has been used very successfully in robotics, where they're talking about the motion of something and the orientation. They've been able to solve problems very neatly this way. Tangling myself up here. So we're talking about then a space which has different geometric objects in it, not really having higher dimensions. We still only have a four-dimensional space. We're just recognizing that there are all the other geometric objects there. There's the planes and the volumes, points. And we're going to give a coordinate to each one of these objects. So I haven't really gone to higher dimensions. I've just sort of added coordinates to the other geometric objects already there. Now you can reinterpret that and think that I'm really just in a higher dimensional space, and that works. We could have a coordinate associated with a scalar. That's where you sort of put scale problems in there, perhaps like the mass. The vector part would be the momentum. And we're going to introduce a coordinate associated with the plane, which is sort of, if you may think about it, is sort of the angular coordinate of the spin. And the way we would parameterize a problem is that the spin would be the mass times this area coordinate. It's kind of very Keplerian, mass times area. Momentum is mass times the velocity coordinate. And you might even consider the mass as being the canonical coordinate to the scalar one, been done by another author. So that's kind of the way I approach the problem. Let's back up and try to do it more rigorously. Whether or not you like the way I introduced it, let me just define a new invariant form, which is I'm going to take my linear coordinate, which describes the momentum motion, and an area coordinate, which parameterizes the spin. Due to that invariant that was given by Dixon, I'm going to subtract the squares of these two things and come up with an entirely new affine parameter. So you don't really characterize things by the proper time. You must subtract off a contribution from the spinning motion. Derivatives will be taken with respect to this new affine parameter, which means, just like in special relativity when we went to proper time, you must introduce a correction factor, which is going to be related to the spin of the particle. The action principle based upon this new length, which is how far you go plus how far you spin, is deceptively simple. We're just going to take a quadratic form, which is how far I went minus how much spinning there was. Of course, I'm adding a length with an area, and those are entirely different units, so there must be a fundamental scale factor introduced. Now, exactly what that scale factor is, for a classically large object, it's just sort of the radius of gyration. The canonical momentum, then, when you vary this with respect to position, you would get the momentum, but with respect to the new affine parameter, and a bare mass, which can be rewritten in terms of the proper time as a spin-enhanced mass, which is what we had on the previous page. So this is consistent with the Dixon invariant. Yes, I see that. Now, if you do this, you will fail because there's some very subtle points. Certainly, we can write down some Lagrangians here, but if you write down the equations of motion that you would get from this or from one of the alternative forms, you will not get the equations of motion in curved space because there's been a bad assumption. When we've introduced this new spinning coordinate, you sort of get like a local frame dragging. Variation of the velocity is no longer the velocity of the variation. So you must go back and look at your Lagrangian mechanics and do it much more carefully. So in varying our Lagrangian with respect to the coordinates and to this new spin coordinate, usually you take this term and integrate by parts. You throw away a boundary term, you keep this term, and then you normally throw away this term. But this no longer vanishes. The variation of the velocity is no longer the velocity of variation. And the job here is really to come up with what that is. You can see it ends up being considerably messy. This is why you can normally ignore it. It's usually just involving a torsion. There's no torsion, it disappears. But now that I've included the spin coordinate, you get a whole series of other terms in there. Same sort of thing with the spin coordinate. You again get a whole bunch of messy terms here. If you put these into there and modify your equations of motion, you will recover the Papa-Petru equations as autoparallels in this space where we have a coordinate for the spin using this new affine parameter. Now, just some things quickly. If you go back and try to do this as a Hamiltonian mechanics problem, you quickly run aground. Do the Legendre transformation, including the new coordinates, vary it. And you certainly find that two of the Hamilton equations looks just like what you would like, but you've lost that wonderful symmetry you have between position and momenta. The other equation is not just this simple. There's going to be a whole bunch of other terms that show up because of this non-commutivity of the velocity with the variation. So I'm not really sure where to go there. It messes up everything. If you want to write down what your Poisson brackets are, they're going to have a whole bunch of extra terms. It's going to appear. And so you can't write down the simple things that the time derivative of an operator is just the Poisson bracket. There's going to be a whole bunch of extra pieces to that, and I'm not sure what that would mean in terms of trying to quantize. Now, since I have a very simple Lagrangian, which does work and does produce the equations of motion, if we think in the other direction, how would this Lagrangian make contributions to a source of gravity? So simply by varying the Lagrange with respect to the metric tensor, we acquire this form. Now again, this is in terms of the new affine parameter. It can translate it back in terms of proper time and get it like this. I've sort of written it down here to first order terms, showing that you certainly have contributions of the spin to both the energy density and the momentum density. This is about as far as I've gotten. This is where I'm now looking. Just try to see what type of equations this would give between two spinning particles, if it looks anything like what people have written down for spinning black holes. But also, if the approach that's been used here would allow one to solve the equations, to integrate them more conveniently than can be done in standard theory. And I don't know the answer to that yet. That's kind of where I am. And I think we'll stop there.
If you have a curved black hole,
I really don't know. I mean, they're giving the right equations of motion. One would hope that I have not completed this part of it, and that's what I'd like to check.
Yeah.
Well, I started with just a classical particle of, you know, classical radius. But then, you know, I've sort of looked down what happens if I start making that the Compton radius. And what you'd like to do is then kind of take the Dirac equation and kind of see if you can match up between the two things. And or you can play some games with varying that Lagrangian with respect to the scale parameter. And I'm afraid I don't really have anything more coherent to say about that. I'd be kind of curious to see if there's an anomalous factor of two that appears somewhere when you get down to a quantum particle. Yeah.
Something nice you can do is, for example, in classical kinetic theory, when you have molecules that are point-like, therefore have no structure, then you get a specific equation of state. Mm-hmm. If you have rotational degrees of freedom, it shows up in the resulting equation of state.
Mm-hmm.
In the average.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So here, since your spins could probably be some sort of relativistic analog for molecules vibrating or rotating. But you need to do it statistically. With kinetic theory, it's very difficult to do it beyond special relativity.
I'm kind of curious also just what happens when you have a fluid with vortices in it. If, you know, if there's a Lindeny, I don't know.
So, well, one
yeah.
The quantity lab that appears in our parallelism is some sort of rate of acceleration.
Well, it's some sort of fundamental scale parameter. Now, it's certainly in, right, if you look at the mass, we can make it the radius of gyration if it's a classical size particle, yes.
And so how do you pick it?
Yes, right, how do you pick any sort of scale factor? And One would want to put in that another piece for the scalar part, and, you know, introduce the mass as conjugate to the scale.
There's some arbitrariness in it.
Right.
But it's striking to me that the Poincaré equations do not involve with lambda. Lambda is something.
Right.
By the time you get to your equation of motion, lambda is dropped down.
Yes. Yeah.
whether there is buried in here some sort of version of this, or some pieces of this lack of proper paper equations are lambda independent, and those are the pieces that the physicists would really grab hold of and say, that's where the real physics is. But you could build a larger mathematical structure that depends on lambda that enables you to get in what may be useful ways at some physical, some physics, which is that piece of this in which lambda drops down.
Are we done? Okay. Thank you.